The Jewish History Soundbites podcast with Yehuda Geber. Immerse yourself in the rich tapestry of Jewish history as we explore fascinating tales and uncover hidden gems from our glorious past. Brought to you by our proud sponsor, Cross River, a leader at the intersection of financial services and technology, committed to empowering the communities they serve. Cross River's steadfast support fuels our mission to preserve our heritage and foster a vibrant future for all. Contact Cross River through their website at crossriver.com.
A date which will live in infamy.
Both of those projects, initiatives, got off the ground because of the Gerer Rebbe.
The 11 Olympic team members slain in West Germany. The Olympic Games.
So gereicht waren die Brüder in Amerika. So tausend Schabbes at the Skizzer.
Out of the 24 who were killed were Americans who had come to learn in Hebron.
I say 1 million Jewish children who were made to be cut in Hussar.
Whoever heard such beautiful words, Hadronavecho Talmud Bavli.
It is never too late. With Jewish History Soundbites, and this episode is about the story of one of the most prominent shuls and really communities in the old city, the Jewish quarter of the old city, the old Yishuv of Yerushalayim, before the shul was destroyed in 1948, and now it's almost completely rebuilt, and it's a prominent stop on my old city tours. We visit the site of the nearly completed rebuilding of the famous, majestic, and beautiful Teferis Yisrael shul, also known as the Nissen Beck shul. In its time, it was known as Rib Nisha's shul, Rib Nisha meaning Nissen Beck. And as it's this shul and its story is quite a big story of its own and fits into the wider narrative of the development of the Hasidic community of the old yeshiv, so I always feel on the tour that we don't have the opportunity to explore the full story with the limited time which we have on tours, because we're busy running around to the entire Jewish quarter and trying to get in as many places and visuals and sites and stories as we can. And there's so much to see in the old city. So I thought that in order to do justice to this shul and its story, I thought that there was a nice opportunity to elaborate on this very interesting piece of history in its own episode on the podcast. And once I mentioned it, so I do old city tours and other historical walking tours in Israel. And of course, I have my tours in Europe, so you should be in touch with me either on your next visit to Israel, where we can do a few walking tours together, or if you, your shul, or your family wants to do a Europe Jewish history tour, so be in touch with me to schedule your tour at Yehuda at YehudaGeberer.com. So everyone says there's two names of this shul. There's the Teferis Yisrael, and there's Nissen Beck. So Teferis Yisrael is because the shul is officially named Teferis Yisrael, and it was named for Rabbi Yisrael Friedman of Rizhin, the Heilige Rizhiner, whose name was Yisrael, and he wanted the shul initially built. He ordered, or requested, that the shul be constructed in the first place. The Beck family, Yisrael Beck the father, Nissen Beck the son, were followers, close followers of the Rizhiner, and they built the shul at his behest. And it was the shul that belonged to Koilel Volin, which was run by the Rizhiner and his agents in Yerushalayim, meaning Yisrael and Nissen Beck. So it was a Rizhiner shul, Rizhin Sadiger, beyond, of course, all that. So so it's named for him, and that's very appropriate that it's named for him. But since Nissen Beck was the one who built the shul and was the gabbai and president of the shul and ran the shul until his passing in 1889, so therefore it was called Nissen Beck's shul or Reb Nish's shul. You have that today. You have, people call Shul's after the one who either funded it or built it or is in charge of it or something like that. You have all kinds of shuls like that around the world. You have, you know, Shiners and Muncie and other shuls like the I assume the Landau's in Flatbush is originally some guy named Landau who built it. I have no idea. It's quite common. So therefore, it shouldn't surprise anyone that it's Nissen Beck's shul, and that's how they refer to it more than the official name of Tiferes Yisrael. It was magnificent in size and grandeur, the architecture and the height. It towered over the Jewish quarter of the Old City, alongside, of course, the shul that was built several years before the Tiferes Yisrael Nissen Beck shul. That's, of course, the Churva shul. So the Churva shul, these two are the twin towers. They're on two sides of the same square, the central square of the Jewish quarter. The Churva shul was the Prushim, the non-Hasidim, the Litvaks, Talmidei Hagra, Prushim, Misnagdim, whatever PC term you prefer to use when referring to them. They called themselves and their community the Prushim, that's generally, or the community of the Talmidei Hagra. Those were the two most common terms that were used by themselves to describe their own community. And there, the Churva shul, which certainly deserves its own episode, we'll get to it, was predated the Tiferes Yisrael Nissen Beck, the Hasidic shul. So the Prushim got there first. They finished the construction of the Churva shul in 1864. The Tiferes Yisrael Nissen Beck shul, which was the Hasidic shul, which was its counterpart, was only finished in 1872. So it came a drop later. But the beauty, I mean, it was high, it was towered over that, and the Churva shul towered over other buildings of the Jewish quarter. And it played, the Tiferes Yisrael Nissen Beck shul played a central role in the Hasidic old yeshiv of Yerushalayim during the time of its existence. It was dedicated in 1872 after nearly 30 years from not a construction. The construction was only about 6 or 7 years from 1866 approximately, or other versions will have the beginning of the construction in 1857. But the idea of building the shul was already from the early 1840s. So it was nearly 30 years in the making. But it was only dedicated, it was opened for use as a shul in 1872, and it was destroyed by the Arab Legion under the command of Abdullah el-Tel in 1948, during and after the battle over the Jewish quarter during the War of Independence, where the Jordanians destroyed all shuls and yeshivas and symbols of Jewish life. So the Tiferes Yisrael Nissen Beck shul came to an end in 1948. So the building itself, well, like I said, it was three stories high. It was quite large and imposing structure. It was a beautiful structure. Really, people described it as the nicest building, the nicest shul in the city. Not only that, but some descriptions referred to it as nicer than any shul in Europe, which I'm not sure. There were some pretty nice shuls in Europe, but let's say nicer than most shuls in Europe, which is pretty impressive because Yerushalayim had a much smaller and poorer community than any community in Europe. It was domed, like the Churva shul, similar. So it had this beautiful dome on top. They actually had to get a special license from the Ottoman government for its height. Generally the Jewish buildings and Jewish places of prayer and religious structures were not allowed to be so tall in Ottoman Yerushalayim, Ottoman-controlled Yerushalayim. So therefore they had to get a special permit for it, which they did. It was three stories high, like I said. It contained a mikveh on the bottom floor. It also had a cheder, a school, on its middle floor. It also had a soup kitchen on either the bottom floor or the middle floor. And the main thing was the very tall, the top floor, very high ceiling, was the shul itself. Now, obviously the contrast is with the Churva shul across the square. The Churva shul was built several years earlier and also grand and also majestic and also beautiful. And, of course, the other contrast is the even older Sephardic synagogues in the Jewish quarter, which were not quite as high and grand, but predated the Ashkenazi shuls by quite a few centuries. So this was the symbol of the Hasidic community. This was their thing, right? So the Churva shuls, the Prushim, the Ashkenazi non-Hasidim, then, of course, the Sephardim had their shuls, and this is the Hasidic community shul. Also, interestingly enough, it's right opposite, and it's a very narrow walkway in between the two, but it's right opposite the Karaite synagogue. So the Karaites, the Jewish community who only believes in the written Torah, the Torah Shebiktav, and not in the oral law, not in Rabbinic Judaism, so they had a community in Yerushalayim which is very, very ancient. It's almost from the beginning of the Karaite times in the 8th or 9th century. So pretty soon afterwards, the community was established in Yerushalayim and they constructed a synagogue. And that is still remains until today. As far as I know, it's even still active with a rather small, tiny Karaite community that attends the synagogue there. But it's a fascinating reality that right opposite the Karaite synagogue is this massive, huge Hasidic Tiferes Yisrael Nissenbeck shul. So in order to better understand how the Tiferes Yisrael Nissenbeck shul came to be, as well as the central role it played in the Hasidic Old Yishuv, it's worth taking a step back as to how the Hasidic community of the Old Yishuv developed altogether. So first we have the first there's an individual isolated incidence of Hasidic individuals, again, not communities, who arrived before the famous 1777 immigration, the Aliyas HaChassidim, which I'll get to in a second. You had, for instance, Reb Gershon Kitover, the brother-in-law of the Baal Shem Tov, who resided in Yerushalayim, but he lived there alone among the Sephardic community. There was no other Hasidim or no other Ashkenazim altogether to speak of. There also was the Reb Nachman of Horodenka, an early student of the Baal Shem Tov and grandfather of Reb Nachman of Breslov, who carries his name, who arrived in Tveria early on also, before the Aliyas HaChassidim. There are a few others as well. But the main community of the main Hasidic community was established with what's known as either the Aliyas HaChassidim or the Aliyas Talmidei Baal Shem Tov. That's the two names that it's given. In 1777, approximately 300, approximately 300 Hasidim, led by two of the greatest tzaddikim, Hasidic leaders in Eastern Europe, Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk and Rabbi Avram Kalisker, and they were students of the Maggid of Mizrich, and they leave White Russia where they were living, and they move to primarily Tveria, but also Tzfas, where they settle. They're both buried in Tveria, in the Chelkas Talmidei Baal Shem Tov, which I do tours of as well, Tveria and Tzfas. So why did they settle there, not in Yerushalayim? So there was no really Ashkenazim legally living in Yerushalayim during this time, which is a whole other story, which is also we have to get to. That's for another time. But there was essentially a ban by the Ottoman government on Ashkenazim living in Yerushalayim during the entire 18th century and early 19th century because of the whole debacle of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, who tried to establish a Ashkenazi community and it didn't really work out and they left all kinds of debt. So the Ottoman government was rather upset about the debt, so they did not allow European Jews to settle in Yerushalayim. They said Jews from the Ottoman Empire are allowed to continue to reside in Yerushalayim, which means that Sephardic Jews who had resided there for centuries were allowed to continue living there and flourishing there, but Ashkenazim were essentially banned from Yerushalayim until almost the mid-19th century, about the 1830s or so. The Prushim succeeded in lifting the ban, and they settled in Yerushalayim, and a few years later they were followed by the Hasidim. So the Aliyas HaChassidim in 1777, they settled in Tzfas and Tveria, as did the Aliyas Talmidei Hagra, who came about 30 years later, the early 1800s. In any event, so in Tzfas and Tveria, the Hasidic community, and later the Talmidei Hagra community, they subsist on the Chalukah system, which I did an episode on a few years ago. And there's the emergence of the Koilalim, and the Koilalim then do not mean like Koilal today. Koilal today means a place where young married men study Torah, and they're supported by the community. The Koilim then were communities themselves, meaning they were based on the geographic origin of the members of the old yeshiv. There's Koilel Volin, which is the focus of today. The Nissen Beck, the Rizhin, Sadiger, it's an area of Ukraine, which was under the jurisdiction of the Rizhiner, who funded the Koilel Volin. You had Koilel Galicia, Koilel Ungarin, which is Hungary, which was called Shaimri HaChoymes. There's Koilel Vilna, Koilel Varsha, Koilel Poilin, Koilel Chabad, and many, many others. There is actually tens of Koilim at its peak, and they're based on the geographic origin of the community. So the Koilim then was a community. They were neighborhoods. They lived in certain areas. They were the chalukah, which they lived off. This chalukah system was funded by the members of their community back in Eastern Europe. So it was an entire communal infrastructure. So this, now the two examples, we're going to focus mainly on Koilel Volin today. There's also Koilel Chabad, which I'll mention. So this Volin is simply a area of today's Ukraine, which was the largest and most powerful of all the Koilim, for sure in the Hasidic community of the old yeshiv, but possibly in the entire old yeshiv, at least in the Ashkenazi old yeshiv. The Sephardic community had the Koilim of their own. The Koilel Volin was under the fundraising apparatus and jurisdiction of the Rizhiner and his agents in Yerushalayim, first in Sfas and later in Yerushalayim, were the members of the Beck family. So the Ashkenazim returned to Yerushalayim. It was spearheaded by the Prushim, by the Talmidei Hagro in the 1830s, Rav Shlomo Zalman Tzorif, and others, Rav Menachem Mendel Shklov, and the Hasidim arrive in Yerushalayim a few years later. So until the completion of the Tiferes Yisrael Shul in 1872, the Hasidic community davened in small shtibels or in people's homes. Actually, one of the earlier Hasidic shuls in the Jewish quarter was the Chabad Shul. The Chabad always makes it first, right? So is the Tzemach Tzedek Chabad Shul. It's actually still active. It's a very prominent shul in the Jewish quarter. There's Rehov Chabad, which was built by Koilel Chabad, and the shul is built by Koilel Chabad, and it's one of the oldest active Chabad shuls in the world. There's an older one in Hebron, actually. It was built in the 1850s with funding from the Sassoon family of Bombay, India, and with the blessing and initiative of the third Rebbe of Chabad, the Tzemach Tzedek, or Menachem Mendel. So that's an example of an earlier Hasidic shul in the Jewish quarter before the Tiferes Yisrael Nissen Beck shul was built. So let's introduce the Beck family. So the story of Yisrael Beck, who comes from this prominent family in Berdichev, they're followers of the Rizhiner, actually even earlier, his father, Yisrael Beck's father, Avram Beck, was in Berdichev. He was actually a follower of Reb Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, the Kedushas Levi. The Beck name is Beis Kuf as an acronym, so they had two little streichelach on top of the Beis Kuf. And the question is, it's unknown what the acronym stood for. Either it was Bal Koire, so that he was the one who laid the Torah in the shul of Reb Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, his father, in other words. And then so he got this acronym, Bal Koire, Beck, or maybe it means Ben Kedoshim, some ancestor of theirs, maybe was killed, was a martyr, was killed Al Kiddush Hashem, so therefore they were Ben Kedoshim, so either way it was Beck, that's what it was. And Yisrael Beck is a prominent family, he's a printer in Berdichev, and a chassid and a follower of the Rizhiner, who had close ties to Berdichev. A few of his children married families from Berdichev, wealthy families from Berdichev, the Rizhiner. So Yisrael Beck decides to move to Eretz Yisrael. And he already had a son, Nissen Beck, who was a teenager at the time. So Nissen Beck grew up in Berdichev. And when he was about 16, he moved. In 1831, the family moved to Tzfas. And they established their printing press in Tzfas. And this is the first Jewish printing press in the entire land of Israel. So this was very prominent, very important, very historic, and made them a very powerful family because they had the monopoly on Jewish printing in Eretz Yisrael for decades, first in Tzfas and later in Yerushalayim. So they were prominent in the printing business. They also established, the father and son, established a farming settlement on Har Meron, which was called Jermak in those days. So 15 families settled in this farming agricultural settlement, which was very, progressive, very visionary, that they have this Hasidic farming settlement, which lasted for not that long, only a few years. The 1830s, it only lasted a few years, but it was certainly the first new Jewish settlement in centuries. I mean, probably in hundreds of years, it was the first new Jewish settlement, because the Jews who lived in Eretz Yisrael throughout all this time, and they lived there for many, many centuries, pretty much consistently since the Churban Beis HaMikdash, there were always Jews residing in the land of Israel, in the Holy Land, and they lived in the holy cities, in Tzfas, Tveria, Hebron, and Yerushalayim. And here, this was a new settlement. It was probably the first one established in a very long time by Jews. In any event, so the Becks are prominent in that realm. They also wisely develop a relationship, a close relationship, with Sir Moses Montefiore. And that serves them well in the long run. Montefiore funded some of the Beck projects over the ensuing decades, and they have a very close relationship with Montefiore. In fact, in 1839, Nissen Beck had a baby boy that was born to him, and Montefiore was visiting the Holy Land at this time, and Montefiore attended the bris and served as the sandik for Nissen Beck's son. And as a gift, a couple of years later, by this time, the Beck family had moved to Yerushalayim, which I'll get to in a second, but in 1842, Montefiore gifted a brand new printing press to Nissen Beck in Yerushalayim, and this new printing press served the printing press's needs of the Beck family and of the old Yeshiva Yerushalayim for many, many, many years. It was sponsored by Sir Moses Montefiore. So the Beck family, Yisrael and Nissen Beck, had a very close relationship with the Rishoner himself. In fact, both father and son traveled back to Sadiger in Austria on several occasions to visit and consult with the Rishoner, to do his bidding with the Hasidic community in Yerushalayim. They corresponded with him and his people, and of course with the Rishoner's son and successor, Rav Avram Yaakov of Sadiger, Rav Avram Yaakov Friedman of Sadiger. So why did the Becks move from Tzfas, or their farming settlement on Har Meron, to Yerushalayim in 1839? So there were two reasons. First of all, we call it the Tzfas earthquake. I did an episode a couple of months ago about the Tzfas earthquake. It was the Galil earthquake of 1837, which destroyed most of the Jewish communal life in the Galil. So they left and moved to Yerushalayim 2 years later in 1839. There is also political changes. The Becks were close with Ibrahim Pasha, who was overthrown, and the area returned to the jurisdiction of the Ottoman Empire in 1839-1840. So because of that political change, they also moved to Yerushalayim. In any event, they move to Yerushalayim. The Beck printing press, for a long time, the only Jewish printing press, they printed many Sfarim, many important Sfarim were printed during this time in their press. They also printed a old Yishuv newspaper called HaChavatzeles, which was an important newspaper, and it was in competition with the other old Yishuv newspaper starting in the 1860s. Halevanein, another famous old Yishuv newspaper, which was started by members of the Prushim community, the competing community of the Ashkenazim, Yoel Moshe Solomon, Yechiel Brill, famous personalities of the old Yishuv from the Prushim side. So the Yisrael Beck brought his son-in-law into the printing business for HaChavatzelos, for this HaVatzelos, this old Yishuv newspaper, Yisrael Dov Frumkin, who took over the newspaper, HaVatzelos. His son was a very famous member of the new Yishuv, actually, Gad Frumkin, who was the first Jewish appointed justice in the British judicial system in Palestine. So he was a prominent figure as a judge. That was Gad Frumkin. His father, Yisrael Dov Frumkin, was the son-in-law of Yisrael Beck and brother-in-law of Nissen Beck, and he ran the Chavetzeles newspaper. Once we're just mentioning the family of Yisrael Beck, so another son-in-law of Yisrael Beck was Shimon Rokach, a very prominent family, the Rokach family, in the new Yishuv. They were more secular, and his son, Shimon Rokach, there are several Rokachs who are quite famous and prominent in the new Yishuv. His son, Yisrael Rokach, was the longtime mayor of Tel Aviv after Dizengoff, after Mayor Dizengoff. The first mayor, so it was Yisrael Rokach for, I think, 15, 20 years or so, was the mayor of Tel Aviv. In any event, Nissen Beck was considered one of the more liberal and forward-thinking leaders of the old Yishuv, as opposed to the more extremist elements who are more remembered in Jewish history, but there are quite a few more liberal and forward-thinking leaders of the old Yishuv, and Nissen Beck was certainly one of those, and there's lots to say on that as well. So among Nissen Beck's leadership roles and accomplishments, he was the head of Koilel Volin, which was Rizhin. He was close with the Rizhiner and leader of the Hasidic community of the old Yishuv. He ran the printing press. He printed the Chavetzeles newspaper. He built the Teferis Yisrael Shul, which we'll get to soon. It was, like I said, it was called Reb Nish's Shul, the Nissen Beck Shul, after him. He also built the Kiryah Ne'emana neighborhood, which was funded by Moses Montefiore. And it was also called Batei Nissen Beck, so he also got the name there. It was right outside Shar Shechem, and it was the first Hasidic built community outside of the old city walls. It was built in 1875. All the other Jewish communities outside the old city walls up until that point were either Sephardic or from the Prushim. So this was the first Hasidic community built outside the old city walls. The neighborhood eventually was a majority Sephardic. There weren't that many Hasidim in the neighborhood. And it was abandoned after the 1929 riots. It was smack in the middle of an Arab neighborhood outside Shar Shechem. Nissen Beck also maintained a close relationship with Sir Moses Montefiore and received funding from him for his many projects. Nissen Beck also built another neighborhood, the Kfar Shiloach Yemenite neighborhood. It was for Yemenite Jews who immigrated to Yerushalayim in the 1890s. This is on the Har HaZesim foothills next to the Arab neighborhood of Silwan. And it was Nissen Beck also established and headed the anti-missionary organization called Ezras Nidachim. And Nissen Beck remained a powerful leader of the old Yishuv until his passing in 1889. So there's a few other notable episodes of the leadership of Nissen Beck before we get back to the Teferis Yisrael Shul project in the old Yishuv. Number one, during the infamous Sanz Sadiger dispute, which was probably one of the worst fights in the annals of the Hasidic movement, which I think I discussed briefly in a few other episodes. But in any event, there was this Sanz Sadiger dispute that lasted for about 8 years, and the remnants, the aftermath, lasted for many, many more years. But in 1869, so Nissen Beck is a close follower of the Rizhin Sadiger dynasty, so he's clearly on the Sadiger side of the dispute against Sanz. So he spearheads a ceremony at the Kaisel, which placed the Divrei Chaim of Sanz, the great and holy Divrei Chaim of Tzanz, the great Hasidic leader, in Cherem, excommunicated, which was a terrible thing to happen. And it was very provocative. And this incident that Nissen Beck spearheaded flamed the fires of the already violent dispute even more. So that was a very central event during that Tzanz-Sadiger dispute. The second thing that he also was involved with, another thing that he was involved with, and Nissen Beck was, together with the Sephardic old Yishuv leadership, Nissen Beck led the Hasidic faction against the leadership of the famous Tzvi Hirsch Lerin of Amsterdam, the Vad HaPkidim V'Ha'amarkelim Leman Eretz HaKodesh in Amsterdam, which is another whole story. So Tzvi Hirsch Lerin was a tough and uncompromising leader of the old Yishuv from his base in Amsterdam, where he controlled the funding. And this... there was a revolt against Lerin from the Prushim also, but before that, there was a revolt of the Sephardic old Yishuv and Nissen Beck of the Hasidic Yishuv against the leadership of Lerin in Amsterdam. And they established the Sephardic old Yishuv leadership and Nissen Beck together established the first Jewish hospital in Yerushalayim in 1844, which was against Lerin. Lerin was opposed to the establishment of a Jewish hospital, which is a whole story. And then again in 1856, Koilel Volin, with Nissen Beck at its head, and the leadership of the Sephardic Old Yishuv, did not oppose the establishment of the famous, or infamous, depends who you ask, Lemel School, which is also a whole story. Unlike the Prushim community went to war against the Lemel School. They put it in Cherem. So Nissen Beck and the Sephardic Old Yishuv led the opposition. They said, no, we're not going to put the Lemel School in Cherem. We can live with the Lemel School. Like I said, he was a little bit more liberal, on the liberal side. So he was a major leader in the Old Yishuv, of the Hasidic Old Yishuv. And we really, really need to do several episodes on the Old Yishuv of Yerushalayim of the 19th century, because there's so much to say about Lerin and his leadership and the Prushim and the Hasidim and the Sephardic Old Yishuv and all of the Koilim and what was going on. There's tons. We need to do at least 5, 6, 7 episodes on the Old Yishuv of Yerushalayim, specifically of the 19th century. So now we finally come to the construction of the Teferis Yisrael Shul. The story goes, and this is more legend than fact, but it's such a great legend that we'll say it even though it's not entirely fact. In 1843, shortly after Yisrael Friedman of Rizhin, the Heiliger Rizhiner, escaped Russia following his imprisonment by the Tsar, which is also a whole story, we have to get to that one day, the story of the Rizhiner and his imprisonment by the Tsar and his leadership, the Rizhiner's leadership of Hasidus and his escape to Austria, and the regal way of the Rizhiner. We have to get to that one day. But in any event, shortly after, in 1842, he was able to escape Russia and make it to Austria, and he left Rizhin forever, and he settled in Sadiger in Austria. So the Rizhiner, and a year later, in 1843, so the story goes, the Rizhiner got wind of the Tsar. The Tsar at that time is Tsar Nicholas I, who was a bitter enemy of the Jews. So Tsar Nicholas's plans to purchase a plot of real estate in the center of the Jewish quarter of the old city of Yerushalayim. And he would build a Russian Orthodox church right there. So the Rizhiner was not too happy about that. So he orders Nissen Beck to purchase that real estate, to swipe it before the Tsar was able to have his people buy that piece of real estate. And Nissen Beck, the Rebbe Gezucht, you know, of course, so he bought that piece of real estate. So the Tsar was forced to purchase instead real estate outside the old city walls, where he bought a huge tract of real estate and built the Russian compound, which today is by Kikar Safra, right next to the Iriya of Yerushalayim, a huge area, Russian compound. There's today there's a Russian Orthodox Church and many other old buildings. Some of it is public property. It's used as a court, and there's a prison and a museum and all kinds of other things. It's a huge area called the Russian compound, Megrash Harusim in Hebrew, and there's still an active Russian Orthodox Church. So now it's outside of the old city walls, so they didn't get it inside the Jewish quarter. Nissen Beck was able to heed the Rebbe's request or command and buy that real estate, and therefore they eventually built the shul there. So why it seems to be more legend, and allegedly the Tsar, when he saw that he couldn't buy that property, that Nissen Beck instead bought the property, he said that Rabbi Yisrael, Rabbiner, Rabbi Yisrael Friedman, the Rizhiner, he got me again. In other words, he escapes from Russia. Secretly, he was able to escape from Russia. So he foiled the plans that I had for him then. And now he prevented me from building a Russian Orthodox church in the Jewish quarter. So that's also part of the legend. Now, why is it more legend than fact? Because the Russian compound only came around to be built around in 1857 to 1860, around that time, like 20 years later. In other words, more importantly than it was 20 years later, but much more importantly, it's after the Crimean War. And Tsar Nicholas is dead. It's his son, brother, I don't even remember the Yichus there, but Tsar Alexander II. I think it's his brother. Tsar Alexander II, after the Crimean War. In other words, when the Ottoman Empire and Tsarist Russia enjoyed a better relationship, as opposed to under the rulership of Tsar Nicholas I before the Crimean War. So and Tsar Nicholas I was the nemesis of the Rizhiner, and all of Russian Jewry for that matter. So it's less likely that the Russian Orthodox Church had serious plans for construction in Ottoman-held Jerusalem before the Crimean War. But who knows? Maybe it is. In any event, there are certain facts that are definitely true. And these are the facts that are true, and those are important. The Rizhiner did run Koyel Volin, and he ran all the fundraising for Koyel Volin Yerushalayim and was very, very involved in the old Yeshiva of Yerushalayim through the Becks, but also raising funds in Europe, and he was very closely involved. His agents were Yisrael Beck and his son Nissen Beck, both of whom visited the Rebbe and his son and successor, Rebbe Yaakov Sadiger, in Sadiger on several occasions. Already in the early 1840s, the Rizhiner explicitly asked that a grand shul for Koyel Volin be constructed and that a plot of real estate be purchased for this purpose, so that his followers should have their own shul in Yerushalayim and not have to daven with other Hasidic groups or with the Prushim, God forbid. So that is a fact. From the 1840s, the Rizhiner already asked that this shul be built. Another indisputable fact is that the Rizhiner himself provided the initial seed funding for this venture, and that he and especially his son and successor in Sadiger fundraised significant funds for the construction of the Teferes Yisrael Shul. But it's also clear how challenging such a venture was, because for over 20 years, no construction even began. The Ottoman Muslim authorities required special permits for the construction of any shul, and for the height of the shul, the plot had to be secured, the plot of land, in other words, and some of the permits had to be obtained from the capital of the Ottoman Empire in Constantinople, today's Istanbul. So it was a long, complicated, challenging process, and construction only commenced in 1866, which was well over 20 years since the Rizhiner had asked that it be built. And of course, the Rizhiner had long since passed away. He passed away in 1850, so that's why the shul is named Teferes Yisrael after him, because he had long passed away before it was finished. And that's when construction began in 1866. And it was finished and dedicated in a very grand and nice, beautiful ceremony in 1872. It was an incredibly beautiful and majestic shul and towered over the Jewish quarter together with the Churva shul. There's another story and more legend, but part of the story is true. There's just some legend added to it with the emperor of the Habsburg Austro-Hungarian Empire and his visit to Yerushalayim in 1869. Now, he actually did visit in 1869, so that part is true. The reason he visited Yerushalayim in 1869 was because there was the very ceremonial opening of the Suez Canal in 1869, and the British government, who were very proud of this accomplishment, this changed world history and world commerce, a major accomplishment, the building of the Suez Canal, there's lots to say about that. So they invited all kinds of world dignitaries for the ceremonial opening of the canal. So once he's in the neighborhood, so to speak, of the Middle East, so Franz Josef, the great emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Habsburg Emperor, he's a Christian monarch, a Catholic, and he becomes the first major Christian monarch to visit the Holy City. It's a holy city to Christians as well, in like 6 centuries, I think since Richard the Lionhearted's crusade, if I'm not mistaken, which was a major visit. So he visits Ottoman Palestine, and the Ottoman government makes a whole ceremony greeting him, and all the communities of Yerushalayim send out delegations to greet the Christian community, all the different denominations of Christianity, and the Muslim community, and of course the Jewish community. Now the Jewish community, there's several Jewish communities, like I said, in the old Yeshiv, but the Koyel Volin community, most of them have Austrian citizenship, and they saw themselves as subjects of Emperor Franz Josef. So Nissen Beck, as the head of the community, he meets with the emperor, which is pretty impressive. And he unbelievably leads the Emperor Franz Josef on a tour of the Jewish quarter. So I always tell my people who take a tour with me on the Jewish quarter that they can consider themselves Franz Josef and his entourage and his family, and me, I'm Nissen Beck, when we're standing in front of the Teferes Yisrael Nissen Beck Shul, I tell them that. So he brings him a tour of Jewish quarter. That's all true. So far, we're still in the truth part, not the legend part. This is all fact documented. And Nissenbeck shows him the shul, and the shul's under construction. It wasn't finished. In fact, the dome was not there yet because they had run out of funds. They weren't able to continue building. They needed more money. And again, continuing with the fact part of the story, Franz Josef was impressed enough and made a donation to the shul. I think 1,000, whatever it was, marks or francs or gulden, I don't know, whatever the currency was at the time. He made a donation. So that's pretty impressive. All that is fact. There's a legend, of course, that's added to it. It's a Hasidic shul, after all. So we have to have some legend that the emperor asked Nissenbeck, Emperor Franz Josef asked Nissenbeck, where's the dome? So there's no dome. So Nissenbeck, thinking quickly on his feet, he says, well, my dear emperor, it was the shul, even the shul was so honored with your presence and your visit to Yerushalayim. So even the shul took off its hat in respect to greet you, so to speak, which was a way of greeting royalty and nobility, aristocracy, whatever it was. At that time, you take off your hat in to honor, it's a form of greeting. And Emperor Franz Josef was so impressed with that clever answer, so he sponsored the entire dome. That's the legend part. Once we're speaking of the dome, so the dome was initially painted green, which was very provocative because the Muslims considered green a holy color and it's a symbol of Islam, symbol of peace. And how dare the Jews paint their dome green? So eventually one of the Rothschilds donated some funds a few years later, like 10, 15 years later, to repaint the dome a different color so as not to provoke the Muslim authorities. So the influence of the shul is quite prominent in the Hasidic community. In fact, there were some Hasidic Jews who arrived or lived in Yerushalayim who were not from Rizhin Sadi Ger. They were not from Kailul Volin. They were from Galicia or whatever, from other Hasidic communities and or dynasties or loyalty to other rebbes. But they joined Rizhin Sadi Ger and they joined Kailul Volin because of the shul's prominence and centrality. Remember, in Yerushalayim, there's not many rebbes anyway. So it's loyalty to a rebbe in Eastern Europe. You want to be part of this big, beautiful shul and community. It's much more impressive. Now, when Avraham Yaakov Friedman of Sadi Ger, the son of the Rizhiner, passed away, so initially his court was run jointly by his two sons, Reb Yitzchak Friedman and maybe it was Reb Yisrael, maybe his name, it was already named for his grandfather, I don't remember. I think I did an episode on the Friedmans. But in any event, it's not in my notes. But that joint running it by the two brothers didn't work out. So a few years later, they split and they cast lots. They did a goyrel, a lottery, who gets what. And the older brother, Reb Yitzchak Friedman, he had to leave Sadi Ger. He lost the court of Sadi Ger, but he won all the Eretz Yisrael stuff. The right to light the fire on Lag BaOmer in Meron, the Tiferes Yisrael shul, the Kailul Volin, the fundraising apparatus for Kailul Volin in Europe. He controlled all that stuff. So he moves to a suburb of Chernivtsi, as was Sadi Ger. Sadi Ger was also a suburb of Chernivtsi, another little shtetl near Chernivtsi called Bayan. So Reb Yitzchak Friedman becomes the first Bayana Rebbe. So the Bayana Rebbes and the Bayana dynasty essentially controlled the Tiferes Yisrael shul, essentially controlled the old yeshiv, the Hasidic old yeshiv of Yerushalayim through the Kailul Volin. And Bayan, in order to fundraise for the shul, they started to sell honorary places in the shul in the early 20th century. So many prominent individuals across the Hasidic world, either wealthy Hasidim or Rebbes or Rabbanim, they purchased seats and they got this fancy certificate you get to hang in your house. Sefer HaMakneh, Mikneh, I think it was called. And it was like the certificate that you got that you owned a seat. And on your seat in Yerushalayim, it actually said your name. Now, these people never even visited Eretz Yisrael. They never even visited Yerushalayim. The idea was it was prestige. It was a symbol that they owned a seat in the central shul of the Jewish quarter, at least for the Hasidic Jewish community of the Jewish quarter, that they owned a seat there. Now, in practical sense, the shul was packed. It was operating at full capacity, but that was by members of the old yeshiv, who in theory didn't own the seats there, but they always davened there, and the shul was full to full capacity. Sometimes people even had to bring chairs from their own homes because there was nowhere to sit. It was always very full, and it was always very central. Now, the problem was that the shul came a bit too late on the old yeshiv scene. Just a few decades later, the Jewish quarter was largely abandoned for the new neighborhoods outside the old city walls. Remember, it's only built in 1872 when there's already construction outside the old city walls. By the 1890s, by the early 1900s, most of the Yerushalayim was outside the old city walls, and the Jewish quarter of the old city lost its prominence and central role and was emptying out. The development of the new city was in full swing. This also was the fate of the Churva Shul. So the Tiferes Yisrael Nissen Beck Shul was neglected, had fewer congregants, and slowly fell into disuse and decline, which is quite sad, because it was such a beautiful shul, and it only had its prominence for, you know, about 30, 40 years, and by the 1910s, it was already in decline. The Bayana Rebbes in Europe, they tried fundraising and refurbishing and promoting it. They even connected it to electricity in the late 1920s, all to no avail. In 1948, the Tiferes Yisrael Nissen Beck Shul, like the Churva Shul, was used as a Haganah outpost because it was so high up. It gave them a good observation. There were fierce battles fought in the Tiferes Yisrael Shul, in the shul itself. It changed hands a couple of times between the Jewish defenders and the Jordanians. Interesting testimony I saw that a fighter, Haganah fighter, descending from his post in the middle of the battle by the dome. His post was by the dome, and he descends into the shul to change his ammunition or something, and he saw Hasidic yeshiva students engrossed in their Talmudic studies in the Beis Medrash during the battle. So you have the Torah being studied and the defenders fighting all in the same building at the same time. Amazing. So like all shuls and yeshivas of the Jewish quarter, unfortunately, the tragic ending is that the Jordanians destroyed it. Almost entirely, the Jordanians destroyed it both during and after the battle of the Old City. Why after the battle? Because the Jordanians, they didn't need to settle the Jewish quarter. The point was that they wanted to make the Jewish quarter Judenrein, free of Jews. So any symbol of Jewish life, they dynamited after the battle. This wasn't only destroyed in the heat of battle, it was actively destroyed even after the battle to make sure there's no remnant and remembrance of Jewish life in the old city. Now, following the Six Day War, 19 years later, in 1967, so the remnants of the Tiferes Yisrael Nissen Beck Shul was not rebuilt. At that time, it just remained a tourist site. But in recent years, especially after the rebuilding of the Churva Shul in 2008, so now there's a commencement of the rebuilding of the Tiferes Yisrael Nissen Beck Shul. Every time I go there, it looks like it's even more and more done. So I think it's almost done, probably within the next year or so. And there's a huge controversy surrounding it, like everything else in Yerushalayim. Is it going to be a tourist and ceremonial site, or is it going to be a shul and a koilel? Of course, Bayan is leading the fight because it's essentially theirs and it's their property. So who knows what's going to happen? Historians are good at reading the past, not at predicting the future. So I'm not going to make any guesses, but time will tell. It is worth noting, though, that the Bayan Central Headquarters, where their main shul is, their main yeshiva is, on Rehov Malchei Yisrael at the top of the Geula neighborhood in Yerushalayim, today, it's the architecture, the dome, the pillars, everything is based on the same design of the then destroyed shul in the old city. In other words, when the Bayan Rebbe of the Lower East Side, the grandfather of the current Bayan Rebbe, Matcha Shloima Friedman, built the Bayan headquarters in the top of Geula, he designed it. He had it designed in a very, not exact way, but a very similar way as the destroyed Tiferes Yisrael shul. By the way, the name of the shul and yeshiva there is Tiferes Yisrael. So it's kind of like the Bayan headquarters, the Bayan central area is named for that Tiferes Yisrael shul. The last point I want to make, which I hope will be like a segue into next week's episode, if it all goes well, is that the Hasidic community of the old Yishuv is Hasidic in a very different way than the rest of the Hasidic community back in Europe. In Europe, one of the central tenets and realities of the Hasidic movement was the loyalty to the Rebbes, the proximity, the physical proximity, and the aliyah l'regel, the visiting of the court of the Rebbe. And in Yerushalayim, in the old Yishuv, there's no formal court or physical presence of Rebbes. They were, in theory, loyal to Rebbes back in Europe. Now, there are many famous and even less famous Hasidic tzaddikim who immigrated and lived in Eretz Yisrael during the 19th century. But most of them were not leaders of formal courts or dynasties. And most members of the old Yishuv were members, officially, at least in name, of dynasties and communities back in Europe. So it's a very different story, the way the Hasidic community lives in the 19th century old Yishuv. And it's worth delving into. But in any event, this leads me, and I hope this to be next week's episode if all goes right, to the story of the first, yes, proper Hasidic dynasty of a Rebbe who did immigrate and subsequently resided in the old Yishuv of Yerushalayim, as did all of his descendants, and that's, of course, Lelov. So I would like to do an episode on Lelov next week. This is Yehuda Geber with Jewish History Soundbites. You can reach me at yehuda@yehudageber.com for questions, comments, sources, tours, trips, sponsorships, and lectures. You can subscribe to Jewish History Soundbites on your favorite podcast platform, and I hope you enjoyed.